this week on Art in the Air features jewelry artist Bobby Rafferty, for who 25 years has created stunning one-of-a-kind pieces that are juried in shows throughout the Midwest and South. Next, Indian artisan Neela John shares her Japanese art forms of Ikebana and Teramani into eye-catching, aesthetically pleasing creations. Our spotlight's on Michael McDermott's Memorial Opera House concert on November 2nd.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art in the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight Michael McDermott, Chicago singer-songwriter. He has several releases throughout the area. He will be appearing at the Memorial Opera House on Saturday, November 2nd at 7:30 p.m. And, of course, he'll probably enjoy being at the newly renovated Memorial Opera House. Plus, he's throughout the Chicagoland area, creative duality, and it's great to have him on Art in the Air Spotlight. Michael, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, aloha, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, we want to start off with, because you've never been on the show, and we talked about already about doing a more in-depth interview, but briefly tell us about your songwriting career, just where are you from? We always used to say in our long interviews, origin story, but briefly tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, it's a long story, and most of it's boring, but so the key points are, outside of Chicago, born and raised, moved into the city, right out of high school, and miraculously got a record contract with Warner Brothers Records, and things were going good for a while. I was the next big thing. When that didn't happen, I had a long, slow, arduous descent into drugs and drink and facing prison time, and it was a long road back from there. So I got clean and sober in 2014, and so just had my 10 years, and things have been great, really, and never better. I'm not on the cover of magazines, but as far as a career goes, it's been a hard, well-earned, rewarding one.
So then did you have a band in high school? What was the...
I did the whole. So that's how I became a folk singer, really, because I was too demanding, I think. And I was one of those people with a very clear vision of what I wanted to do, and it was hard to keep a band together. So then when I moved in the city, I was just starting over. I was just a guy with a guitar, and I would go to the Irish coffee houses and open mics and try to do the John Prine thing, Earl of Old Town, and was mentored by great, great folky from the 70s and Mike Jordan. And anyway, that was kind of it. And then it happened very fast, and it was very fast and lucky. But as soon as it came, it disappeared almost as quickly.
So describe your music style, or was it transition? You touched on it briefly, kind of folkish, but do you want to hear your music style? What would you describe it as?
Well, it's some of it's kind of very story based, because I think, growing up, I had the formative years were playing Irish, Irish folk music, and you know, with those long, terribly sad stories, you know, that their songs are so old they don't even know who wrote them anymore. And that was a very formative part of my thing. And then, you know, I got into Dylan and Springsteen and Tom Waits and Van Morrison, and so it came out before it was called Americana. It is, I mean, now it's a whole genre, but which is just kind of heartland rock. That's what they called it too back when I was coming up.
I know some of the lyrics, it's very, you know, kind of reminiscent of the style of like that Americana John Mellencamp, you know, that, sure, where you really tell a story in a song. Right.
Yeah, definitely. And I actually dated Lisa Germano, who was in John's band for a while. And John is not a very pleasant man. But yeah, he was great. And my first record was produced by Don Gaiman, who produced all those great Mellencamp records. Yeah.
When someone comes to your concert, what can they expect?
Well, I'm going to break them down. I'm going to get them as close as I can to actually crying. And then they walk out feeling... No, I do. Seriously, that's kind of what it is. It is. I would have never even said this if I didn't hear it a million times. But just like, you know, they say it's like church. They say it's like an AA meeting. They say it's like, you know. So I try. I do. It gets heavy and it's not easy music, but it's rewarding. And I do. And nobody walks out of there feeling worse. You know, that's the goal. And we talk about some heady stuff. But the goal it would be to walk out feeling more hopeful. I read a review right before I came on. A guy said, there's no other artist working today that can go farther into darkness and still leave you walking out with hope, you know. So
wow.
I was like, that's a great quote. I'm going to use that somewhere. But yeah, so that's kind of that's my whole now. It was never set out to do that, but it just became that is what I do. And so I like it. I think that's all in all, I'll take it.
Michael, do you, in the concert then, will there be something from like the beginning to now? Because now you have two new albums out, Lighthouse on the Shore and East Jesus. But
I'll do a bunch from there. But I mean, that's 20 songs. I'd probably only do half of those. And then, you know, stuff spanning 30 years, you know, so
it's good.
I touch on everything for sure. And, you know, usually the, you know, it's so funny. I saw David Crosby at City Winery not that long ago. I don't know, 5 years ago or something, but he was doing a new album. But of course, you know, people had to endure all the new stuff to get to the old stuff, which I thought I never want to be like that. So I, you know, I'll mix it in as we go, just to, you know, keep people on the hook.
Great. Now, are you performing with the Arsonists on the Memorial Opera House concert?
I am. That's November 2nd. And it's funny. We do a thing. We're doing one October 19th in Forest Park. We do a thing once a year called Halloweenstein, which is what we do. We do a Springsteen show, which we don't dress up or anything silly like that. But we do a Halloweenstein show once a year. And then, then doing November 2nd, Memorial Opera House. Then I'm going east for a bunch of dates by myself after that.
Well, you know, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air Spotlight. We're going to invite you back for a more in-depth interview to share your music. But we wanted to get this in for Memorial Opera House that you're coming there. And I think you'll enjoy. We just interviewed Scott, who's back as executive director. And they just completely renovated, new lighting, new sound, everything. Be exciting place for you to go. So
I can't wait. Yeah, it's going to be great.
So that's Michael McDermott. You can find out more about him at michael-mcdermott.com. And Memorial Opera House Saturday, November 2nd at 7:30 p.m. There still are tickets available, but they are going fast. So please do that. Michael, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Spotlight.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
And a Spotlight Extra. November 3rd is the next date for the book launch at South Shore Arts Gallery Shop event. It's a Christmas local event, Millennia of Progress, 1933 through 2023, the Chicago World's Fair, Why Tales, If Houses Could Talk, is a companion book of the World Fair buffs will love. Again, that's November 3rd at the South Shore Arts Gallery. Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts.
This is Coach Kiki, Keela Parkinson of Kiki Productions, Inc. Communications Coaching and the host of Tune In, Radio for Your Mind, Body, and Soul. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Bobby Rafferty to Art on the Air. Bobby is a jewelry maker who is predominantly self-taught and who has been working with beads for over 25 years. She creates one-of-a-kind pieces with a focus on color, texture, and form. Her work has been featured in galleries, art shows, and museum shops. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Bobby. It's very nice meeting you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, really glad to have you and glad to reconnect after we were at the For the Love of Art Fair. That's where my wife and I met you at, actually at the bar, I think we were sitting there. So
You're giving away all the secrets of the artist there, Larry.
Well, of course. Yeah, but, you know, it's after a full day of, you know, displaying your art, I guess that's part of it. So I think that was one of the few places inside that hotel that you could actually get something to eat, too. So that was part of it.
All right. Justification, right. Not necessary.
Okay. All right. Okay. I know, because sometimes we practice eat, drink, and be Larry. So. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, we want to know about you, Bobby. We had a chance to visit when we were there, but I think our audience would like to know your origin story. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Bobby.
Sure. I say I'm Southern by birth and Midwestern by luck. I was born in South Carolina. My parents were both professional musicians. My dad was a conductor. My mother was an opera and musical theater performer.
Wow.
And teacher. So I grew up in and around orchestras and the arts and performance and all of that. Studied, you know, violin and piano as one does as a small child, and realized by virtue of being around all of those professional musicians that I was mediocre at best. And so pursued a career that would keep me close to the arts, but not inflict myself on audiences in a performance sense. So I went into arts administration, arts management. And that took me to Dallas, Texas, where I did my grad school work and then worked for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. And again, hanging out with professional musicians, married a violinist. And so I've been incredibly fortunate, you know, as his career took him to various places, you know, being in arts management, wherever there's a job for a violinist, there's a job for someone who can be on the other side of it all. So we've been in Dallas, Texas, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Louisville, Kentucky, and then finally my job brought me to Chicago. So we are now here in Chicago and just love it.
And what is your job currently?
I work for the Chicago Symphony. I'm in the development area for the Chicago Symphony. So that's the day job. And the jewelry is my creative outlet. When we lived in, where were we? Milwaukee. I took a class. I saw a class advertised for jewelry making, introductory jewelry making. And I thought, ooh, that sounds fun. So I signed up and went and discovered quickly that it was really more geared towards the kinds of jewelry making projects that you could do with a scout group or something like that. It was very beginner, very very elementary stuff, but it was enough to introduce me to the terminology and some of the materials and things like that. And from there, it kind of mushroomed. You know, it was just enough information for me to be dangerous. So, you know. But
so after that first class, where did you take it then?
I really did a lot of looking in books, you know, and exploring in books. I got into chat groups online, you know, that would not necessarily teach me things, but, you know, say, oh, this is what you call that kind of bead, or this is what you call that kind of finding, which is the term for the little like clasps and jump rings and things that you use to connect things to each other. So it was kind of a cobbled together growth, and I started with very simple things, you know, just basic stringing kinds of necklaces and making earrings and things like that. And took some pieces into a gallery once and, you know, showed them to her, to the owner. And she said, well, you know, these are nice, but if you're going to spend all the time making the jewelry, don't finish them off with, you know, less expensive. Don't cheapen it with the clasps that you used. And basically, she was saying, you know, don't go to Hobby Lobby and buy something for 99 cents and put it on a piece that you think is worth $100, which, you know, made a lot of sense. So that spun me into, okay, how do I make my own clasps? So, you know, that got me into some wire working. So things build on each other through the years. And the more I did, the smaller the beads got. You know, I started working with seed beads and working with the off-loom weaving techniques and combining with the larger beads and just really exploring where the pieces took me.
Were you also frequenting art fairs to see the types of work that was being produced?
I was. Although, you know, I loved going to art fairs before I even started doing things like this. I'm just, you know, I love the eye candy. I love going and seeing how 100 different people can express themselves visually, you know, whether it's painting or photography or fiber or jewelry or anything. It's just so inspirational. So, yes, I always loved doing that. And, you know, once you get to a certain point in making, you know, you say, well, I'll dip my toe into doing shows. And you learn a lot doing that, too. So, yeah.
So what were those first, what was the first show and what was the experience like? Because sometimes it's, sometimes it's welcoming and sometimes it takes a while to be welcomed in.
Yeah, sure. You're absolutely right. Now, this was a very local show in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I think it was like not quite the equivalent of a farmer's market, but it was kind of, you know, a weekend local artists gathering. And it takes a lot of courage, you know, to get out there and show your stuff because you think it's fabulous and people walk by and go, eh. Yeah. that could be a real ego blow. But, you know, it was fun. It was fun to talk to people about the work. It was fun to get the, you know, to see their reactions and hear their reactions. I learned not to display my earrings on a window shutter because one good gust of wind sends it sailing across the parking lot. So, you know, it's all learning, not necessarily the way you expect, but it's all learning.
It's so true. I know the moment somebody first puts on a piece is quite amazing.
Oh, it's wonderful. And the best is when you see it out in the wild, you know, when you catch somebody wearing a piece that they got from you. It's just a real joy.
I see on your website the marriage of music and one of the pieces you have laying on a sheet of music. So I can see that there's sort of a juxtaposition of that, everything. And of course, the website is a
Bead Song. No, that's okay. That's, you know, and so, but you're right. It's the combination of the beads and the music influence and trying to bring those two worlds together.
So how do they overlap, you know, in your day-to-day worth? I mean, you know, you're out there raising money for the symphony, which, you know, everybody in the non-for-profit world is doing. It's like,
cheers to that, right?
Right. But, you know, your time for this is, do you have a special time that you work on your beads? Like, is there a set time? Like, okay, every day I'll do a little bit in the studio or maybe the weekend, or how does that work for you?
It's the weekends are fertile ground for getting in the workshop, but it's really nice to catch a little bit of time here and there. It's a great meditative kind of process. So for example, if I have a big event coming up at work and I'm, you know, kind of getting ready, I'll try to find an hour where I can just sit and work on a project, you know, just to get your head out of everything else, you know, to turn on the other side of the brain. Because I don't play an instrument. I don't perform. This is kind of my opportunity to express whatever creative urge I have. And like I said, it can be very meditative and very centering. And, so any time that I can find to get in there and work on something, even if it's, you know, just laying something out to finish off later, I find I'm in a better headspace afterwards.
Bobby, I want to ask a childhood question.
Sure.
So you have this very highly musical family. We're mm-hmm. talking about orchestras and opera.
Right.
So as a family, as a young child, mm-hmm. how was music? I mean, did you play together? You say you really don't play an instrument, but you were doing piano and violin. So I was kind of like, as I was doing, you know, some reading about you, I was like imagining, oh, do we have like the Von Trapp family singers here, like in the household? So I was just kind of wondering.
Funny you should mention that. No, because it, just by virtue of, you know, the family and what they did and things like that. Yes, I was, you know, often in musical productions that my folks were involved with. My dad, you know, as a conductor, would be down in the pit. My mom would often be the lead, and I was in a lot of children's choruses growing up. You know, I was in 3 different productions of The Sound of Music. So yeah, Von Trapp family singers right there. So you know, it was great because you know I got to see the inner workings, you know, the backstage, the on stage, the in the pit, the in the audience, and really gain a real appreciation of what it takes, you know, to do anything artistic. You know, I think the goal is you get up there and you want it to look like it's just a snap. It's easy. You know, it comes to you naturally. There's a whole lot of work behind everything, you know, right. Behind a performance, behind a piece of jewelry. You know, somebody says, how long did it take you to make that? I say, well, 30 years,
right.
You know, because that's the, you know, that's the experience that you bring to it. Now, I don't say that often because it's a little snarky, but, you know, any kind of artistic expression, I think we bring the background of what we've experienced and what we've seen and who we admire and you know, how we're feeling and how we respond to the day, to what we put out there.
I understand the Sound of Music issue. You know, I was a theater director, and my daughter was in multiple productions. At 5, I put her in as Gretel. She was in a professional production as Marta. She was in another production as Marta. And she went through about 4 different productions.
Yep.
So, yeah, it is that way.
Double Greta, 1 Brigitta.
There you go.
Yep.
Well, being familiar with the bead world myself, the big shows... which big shows do you go to gather your beads? I mean, it's an intoxicating experience. I mean, just like any, you know, like going to a fabric store for a fiber, you know, person, like beads are just.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's pretty amazing. I will source materials just about anywhere. You know, if I see something that has a hole in it, it's not, you know, it's fair game. So I go to, you know, there used to be one up in Milwaukee called the Bead and Button Show, which sadly is no more. You know, I go to a number of wholesale shows that come through the area. I will go to thrift stores, you know, and find older pieces and repurpose beads or repurpose pendants and things like that, which I think is a lot of fun to reimagine, you know, something that someone has loved in the past into something that might be a treasure for someone in the future. So often when I go on a sourcing journey, I don't necessarily have a specific goal in mind. You know, I might have one or two things that I'm looking for, but I also know that if I see something and it speaks to me, I may not know exactly what it wants to grow up to be, but I need to get it. and I'll have it, you know, in the workshop. I'll have it in the stash. And eventually I'll pull it out and know what I want to do with it.
Yeah, what it wants, for sure.
Yeah,
I had a strand of beads that I had to have, and it was 15 years before I knew what to do with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But then I knew, and then Then
it's perfect, and it just flows, and it's great. So, yeah, that's it's a lot of fun. Of course, it ends up that you think, oh, I must have those. And you go home and you find out that you have 3 other strands of them.
But, yeah, you know, we're attracted to what we're attracted to.
It means you're consistent, you know.
So what do you have time to do art shows anymore, or what's your primary source of getting your work out into the public?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's tricky in my current position, you know, because there are a lot of concerts that, at night. But I am able to do shows predominantly in the summer. But, you know, art shows are usually Saturday, Sunday things. So, you know, there are times when I can sneak away. No.
Yeah. Well, there's so many in the Chicago area.
There are. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that I can find a lot of places to do a lot of shows to participate in that don't take me away from the area too far. The most distant one I'm doing this year is, in mid-October, October 19th and 20th, down in Alabama, called the Kentuck Art Festival. So that's a combination of doing a wonderful art fair and going back to some place I used to live and seeing friends. So, you know, if you can combine them that way, it's great. I probably do about 10 a year currently.
Oh, that's a healthy amount.
Yeah, yeah. At a certain point, I was doing probably 15 or 20 a year. You know, so each year ebbs and flows and changes and switches. But I've been fortunate enough to find some galleries here and there, you know, that will feature my work. Have been juried into the Artful Home catalog. So that's been a real thrill.
Very nice.
So, you know, it's that's finding ways to share your work is as creative as getting the work together.
Right.
So, but for the love of art, the fair last year was such a treat, you know, because I met Shireen, who's the organizer, the manager of the show. She came to a show that I was doing in the Chicago area. We met, we chatted, she invited me, and I just love it. I'm thrilled to have done it last year. I'm happy to, you know, get to look forward to doing it again in February this coming year.
Beautiful venue, comfortable.
It really is. You know, anything you can do that's inside where you don't have to worry about wind, rain, snow.
tent blowing away.
Hurricane. I have done a show in a hurricane. That's an adventure. You know, so it's really a luxury when you can be in a setting like that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, is how you, Shireen, hooked up together, because we've been interviewing artists that have been in her show, and that's she invited me to come. And in fact, this year she invited me to actually come and exhibit. I'm just not set up to do that right now. You know, it's like a little bit too busy, and I do have probably a fair amount of inventory, but I just do gallery things. But yeah, she said, hey, I have a photography slot, would you like to do it? And I said, I just don't think
you should take the leap.
Well, yeah, but I would really have to inventory up a little bit on some of the smaller items, because most of the stuff I have are 20 by 30 on canvas gallery wraps. So, you know, it's bigger pieces. So one of these times maybe, but you know, in my spare time when I'm not doing radio.
Right. Get that creative outlet, Larry. No, but you're right. That's another thing you learn by doing the shows, is how to mix, you know, big things, little things, extravagant pieces to wear every day, you know. So that's part of it too.
So what's your schedule look like going into the fall? Is that a big time for you to exhibit and go out with different art fairs? And
actually, I'm a little slowed down right now. I've got the Kentuck Art Fair that I mentioned in October the 19th and 20th. And then I'm kind of away from it until December, when I do the one-of-a-kind art show here in Chicago. That's at the Merchandise Mart. And that is, I'm looking on my calendar.
It's like the beginning of December.
Yeah, it's early December. And I'm sorry, I don't have the date right on here. But after that, it's For the Love of Art. And then the spring, we gear back up.
Sounds great. So your everyday job, you can give a plug to the symphony there. I think it'd be fine, you know, what to do just briefly if people are interested, you know, since this is in the Chicago market. So.
Yeah, Chicago Symphony Orchestra. We have something every weekend going on here. We have, of course, the Chicago Symphony itself. We do a jazz series. We do a piano series. We do chamber orchestra or chamber music series. We have the Civic Orchestra of Chicago, which is our professional pre-professional training program. So if you're in Chicago and you have a hankering for great music, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra is your spot.
And if they want to support it, how do they do that?
Oh, Larry, that's so wonderful. You go to cso.org, and there is a donate page. We have all kinds of levels, all kinds of ways, all kinds of things you can support.
Excellent. And
oh, that's great.
Well, you know, it's important that the, you know, I always say, kind of paraphrasing Ben Franklin about the arts is certainly if we don't hang together, we'll hang separately. And I think, you know, arts need to support each other. And I think that's very important in what we're doing. Well, also in the last couple minutes here we have is we want to give you a chance to tell us about your website, how people are going to reach out to you and things like that.
Sure. The website is beadsongjewelry.com. It's all one word, Beadsong Jewelry. I am also on Instagram and Facebook as Beadsong Jewelry. Instagram is where I put the newest stuff. The website, it's a little harder to keep updated because everything is one of a kind. And sometimes when it's in, it gets sold and it's gone. but yeah, I'd love for people to connect there. And of course, come to the one For the Love of Art in February and we can talk face to face and, you know, just geek out over some jewelry.
That's great. Yeah, it's a fun thing to do at those art fairs is you get to meet people face to face like we met. And I was going around meeting people and it's the interaction, I think, is very, very important at those type of events and everything. Well, Bobby, thank you so much for coming on the show. Beadsong Jewelry, Bobby Rafferty. And again, you can find her on Facebook. You can find her, of course, on Instagram. And her website, even though it's not as current, but it's very artistic. When you first pull up the page, you have the beautiful piece laying on a sheet of music, which kind of reflects your entire life. Bobby, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We'd like to thank you for listening to Art on the Air. Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art on the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art on the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you.
This is Mary Clark, the author of Dandelion Roots Run Deep, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Nilu Jain to Art on the Air. Nilu is a fiber artist specializing in the Japanese traditional folk craft of temari. The temari balls are made with bright colored threads, elaborate embroideries, intricate wrappings, stunning stitching, and a multitude of patterns. They are considered a symbol of love, esteem, and honor, and also symbolize deep friendship and loyalty, wishing the recipient a brilliant and happy life. She also has workshops and online classes in temari and Ikebana. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Nilu. It's such a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry and Esther, for having me here. I'm honored to be on this show today, and thank you for a wonderful introduction, too.
Thank you so much.
We'd like our audience to find out more about you, and we want you to tell your story, what I call your origin story. And how I'll tee that up is how you got from where you were to where you are. So now tell us all about yourself.
Well, I'm from India, and there are three different cities in India that I call home. I grew up and spent most of my childhood in Jaipur, which is also called the craft capital of India. Growing up, I was surrounded by many artisans of different kinds. There were miniature painting artists, there were weavers, tie dyers, jewelers. And I was introduced to hand embroidery by my much older cousin sister, who would actually make embroidered saris. Now, her work was so meticulous that the back of the sari looked exactly like the front. And I think under her guidance is where I developed an eye for detail and precision. When I was in 11th grade, I moved to Baroda, another equally vibrant city, and it's known for its rich textiles and embroidery. In high school, I was I developed a huge interest in fashion, and I went to do an undergrad in clothing and textiles. When I was doing my undergrad, I developed a huge interest in history of clothing. I would be fascinated by just how intricate the fabric, the weave, and the embellishments were in the past, and simply, and how simple the tools and the looms were, which created these beautiful fabric. I went to National Institute of Design, which is a prestigious school in Ahmedabad, and I did a course in apparel design. This is where I learned the elements of design, the theory of color, and mastered the skills for creating a garment. As one of the graduation requirements, we had to study a craft and document it. After a lot of research, I chose to study this community called Juts. Now, Juts is a nomad community. They have migrated from Balochistan to India many years ago, and they basically live on camelback, going from one place to another, finding work and water. Now, this community had really detailed embroidery work and intricate jewelry. So the women folk would take the leftover fibers, fabric, broken mirrors, and do this embroidery on their kaftan, which just looked beautiful.
So beautiful.
Yeah. I spent a month with them, traveling with them, and I realized how humble their living was, and yet how intricate and embellished their work was. So it was a beautiful experience, and I think that's where I developed my interest in craft. So I came back to NID, and it was not just this craft. I started looking at crafts from all around the world and studying them. Now, after I finished my postgrad, I went to the third city called Bangalore, which is the south of India, and started working as a ladies' wear designer for this export house. They used to manufacture garments for big chains in the US like DKNY, Gap, Tommy Hilfiger. I used to do their domestic line and design ladies' wear. That's when I met my husband. We got married. And then 1 year into the marriage, he decided to move to Arizona to do his MBA at Thunderbird, which is the International Business School. So when I came there, everything was very new. This was my first time outside India. And I was just intrigued by the craft of Native Indians. I started working with the curator, Mr. Dean Warner, and he had this amazing collection of textiles and art from all over the world. And he was doing this project where he was restoring and framing all these textile pieces and artworks, and I helped him with it. Cutting the long story short, in 2005, after my husband graduated and he was in his job, we were posted in Japan. And I think that's where my Temari story begins. So, I just loved Japan. I was drawn towards their architecture and gardens, their simplicity of lines and yet so powerful, and their minimum yet detailed approach to everything. Using apparel as my background, I started working with theater and doing the costumes for theater, mainly for kids, children theater. But I soon realized that my interest lies more in the finesse of the fabric and the quality of construction of a garment rather than just the superficial visual look. So that's when I met, in 2005, I met my sensei Michiko Shimizu, And she took me under her wings, and she was my temari sensei. And I think I trained under her for almost 11 years, and I think I found my ikigai.
And it's after hearing your whole background, I can see it all in the intricate designs that you do in your temari. So what a rich background to bring into it, because your designs are so unique and complex and, multicultural sort of influence.
I base my design out of, the techniques are Japanese.
Yes.
I think this whole exposure to different cultures and different countries, it's kind of becoming, there's a little bit of Indianness to it, there's a little bit of Japanese to it, and I kind of adapt. I want to keep the simplicity of the craft. So I use really simple tools which are locally available. And traditionally in Japan, they would use rice husk as a core of the ball. Here, I'm trying to experiment using corn husk, because mm-hmm. that's the locally produced grain here.
And so how do you start? Do you start on paper? You start with your imagination, of course, but how do you actually start a piece?
So there are different times, different things. I usually, it's a three-dimensional art. It's not 2D. So there's a little bit of geometry involved. There are various techniques to divide the whole ball into different shapes, like pentagons and hexagons. And sometimes I flatten those pentagons and hexagons in 2D and then design my work on paper. Sometimes I just make the grid lines on the sphere itself and then design my work there.
I know, but they're so intricate. It almost seems like you're approaching your sphere and... do you see what you're going to do? Or because your color palette is anything goes, really. So how do you refine what you're going to say?
So there are a lot of hits, trials and misses. Sometimes I just know right away that this is going to work and I go ahead with it. There are a lot of times when I have to remove or redo the stitches. A lot of designs have many layers to it. So I start with the background color and then I build on top of that. So there are times when you are building on top, the image that was in the first layer is like it totally disappears and something new appears. And it's just experimenting and doodling. On a ball.
Yeah. So I want to go way back to childhood again. And what were you physically doing as a child and in your family? Was there a lot of art going on? I mean, the visuals are there. I mean, yes, how do you get more rich than India with all the, like every possible craft and skill? What were you and your family doing?
So I was, most of my childhood was in Jaipur, and Jaipur is this a rich city when it comes to architecture and textiles and jewelry and pottery, printing, everything.
Color,
yeah, it's mm-hmm. so vibrant. But I used to live with my grandmother, and I was never a very sporty person. So at school, we still had the colonial system. And at school, we were, the whole school was divided into four houses, we call them. And they were inter-house competitions. So I would always take part in art competitions, and I would win many prizes. I mean, I have I started with painting first, and then finally my teacher said that, why don't you, you have won so many prizes in painting, why don't you try something else? And then that is when I started doing embroidery and knitting and crochet and everything. And I settled down with tie and dye, which is like a shibori work on fabric. And I think I was just surrounded by this amazing palette of color and amazing techniques on fabric. And that's what interested me.
Was your grandmother embroidering, you know, because that's how I picked up everything from my mother, all my embroidery from, you know, my grandmother and my mother.
Yeah, no, my grandmother was not embroidering, but it was my older cousin's sister. She used to make these beautiful saris, and she used to also come and live with us for, it was kind of a joint family where people came and lived for a longer period of time and went kind of thing. And I think my embroidery skills come from my sister.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM on WVLP 103.1 FM. You also do another kind of art. It's a like floral arrangement. I think it's called Ikebana. It's arranging of blossoms. Tell us a little bit about that.
So that too, when we were in Japan, I was just, Japan is again another country so rich in when it comes to art and craft, and they all these things have been passed from generations, and they take so much pride in just fine-tuning all the craft. So when I was in Japan, I was intrigued by their Zen gardens, by their just love of nature. And each flower was appreciated. There were festivals around each bloom, and I just got interested in flower. Now, Ikebana is one of Japanese renowned kind of flower arrangement. And there are many schools which teach different kind of arrangements. So I joined the Sogetsu School of Ikebana. And my sensei, Rumiko Matsumura, I was trained under her for almost 11 years again. Mm-hmm. And that's my another passion. So this is using minimal flower, but the line and the composition and is so important that you start seeing not just the flower as an object, but also the empty space in and around the arrangement. So, yeah.
And do you have anything to do with the design of the vases that they go in, or that's just part of what exists?
No, I have a big collection of vases, and then when I buy my floral material, I try to see which one is going to look good with that, and then I go ahead from there. But now ceramic and vases is just totally another level art in.
Yeah,
in
quite a specialty.
Yeah, quite a specialty. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when did you start doing the online classes? I think it's like a brilliant thing to do.
Yeah, it all started during COVID. So I used to teach Ikebana and Temari classes while we were in Japan. So we lived in Japan from 2005 to 2021.
Wow.
And I used to, after a few years of learning, I started teaching, and mostly to the expat wives, and then also came Japanese people. It was kind of new for them to learn their art from a foreigner. So I used to run classes, and then came COVID, and we were all at home doing nothing. I was not having classes. My students were getting bored, so then we decided to start doing them online. So on 2021 is when we moved back to Indianapolis, and then I just continued taking these classes for my students in Japan and now all over the world.
I know that's the exciting part about the online world, is that you do meet an international community in some of these classes.
Yeah.
So they're still ongoing now, right?
Yeah. Most of the students in my classes are by students who were in Japan with me. I haven't really started teaching brand new people on Zoom yet, but I think I should do that soon.
I'm curious what you would like to do away from art. Is there something that you enjoy that's not part of your art world?
I love to travel. I love to see how people behave. I love to go to grocery stores and see what kind of food each country has. And we have traveled more than 20 countries over all these years. And it's just amazing to hear different languages, different clothing, different textiles, different art, and different food.
Now, the history of tamari, tell us a little bit about that. They weren't really decorative objects when they were started. What were they?
They were actually humble beginnings. They were used as a toy to play with. So many years ago, mothers would take their old kimonos and pull out threads from there and wrap it on anything bouncy like a sea sponge or just a leather ball and wrap it and make it into a ball and have their kids to play with them. If you look at old Japanese scriptures, there are many songs and folk songs and nursery rhymes which are around temari. And even today, when you go to kindergarten, the kids learn how to play with ball and catch and sing those songs along. So it began as a toy, and then over the years it was fine-tuned and they started using more rich fibers like silk, and it became luxurious and it became an art for the imperial household. And when it became the art for imperial household, it was kind of banned for the common people. And then after came the World War, and then after the World War, everything luxurious was banned, and so was temari. And there is this whole generation which didn't work on it or didn't know about it. So it was kind of lost in between. And now there are a few families in Japan who are trying to revive it. When I meet my age people in Japan and ask them about temari, they would always say that, yeah, my grandmother used to do it or my great-grandmother used to do it, but then it's kind of dying art. Yeah.
So tell us about Indiana Artisan and the process you did to become an Indiana Artisan that you currently are.
So when I came from Japan to here in 2021, I live in Carmel, and I was just walking down the street and I saw the store. I went inside and I met Rosalind. She's such a wonderful lady. And I was telling her about my art and I was showing it to her, and she said, oh, this is lovely, and why don't you jury in with us next year? Because I guess you have to live here for at least a year to become an Indiana artisan. So yes, I did that and I got into it, and that's where I display my work now. I also display my work at CCA, which is the Center of Creative Arts in Carmel. And it's a cooperative store, and we are around 40 artists who represent there.
Oh, how wonderful.
You know, we only have a little over a minute left, but we want to give you a chance to tell people how they can find you, like the online, find out about your classes. And also, you did tell us some of where your art is, but how they can view your website and things like that.
Yeah, so my website is my name, neelu-jain.com. It's neelu-jain.com. You can get in touch with me through my website. There is a contact detail there. Otherwise, I display my work at Indiana Artisan and CCA in Carmel. And I'm a feature artist in the month of October. So the second Saturday of October, which is the 12th, I'm going to be there's going to be an artist reception at CCA, and I'm going to be there from 4 to 8. So if you want to just come in and talk.
Yeah. And meet you in person. That's fantastic. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing your arts journey and your creative. That's Nilu Jain, and you can find her at nilujain.com. We'll have a link on our website on her picture. You click on that, and it'll take you right there. And you can find her also on Instagram and through the CCA Art Gallery. Nilu, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your art journey.
Thank you. It was a lovely story.
Thank you, Larry and Esther.
Coming next week on Art in the Air features two local theater directors, both sharing their career journeys. First, the newly reappointed executive director of the Memorial Opera House, Scott P.J. McDonald, and next, the new artistic director for Toll Theater, Deanne Stover. Our spotlights on La Porte County Symphony's 52nd season opener with a vibrant musical tribute to Latin American music and the Day of the Dead with executive director Emily Iannis. We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.